Okay, there's some questions. Dear Ajahn, may I know who are the top three teachers except Ajahn Brahm who have helped you experience a breakthrough in your meditation? Okay, and may I know which vasa is the most unforgettable vasa throughout your ordainhood, sadhu? Oh, I'd have to think about that. I've never really ranked them, the teachers. But I can answer the second one pretty easily. Well, the first time I ever went to Asia in my life was when I was a monk with about six or seven vasas. I think I had seven vasas. I went to Sri Lanka to a monastery called Na Uyana. And I had heard that they had this place called the Solo Retreat Area, where the duties were quite minimal, and you could sort of have your own meditation schedule, your own daily schedule. And even though I'm not from their lineage, that lineage is called the Galdua lineage, but they have Vinaya, very similar to the Ajahn Chah lineage where I'm from. So after they got to know me for a couple of weeks, I, like, just staying not in the solo retreat area, but kind of the part where every monk starts off. They call it the lower monastery. Then I obtained the permission to go to the solo retreat area. And I lived there for about 15 months. 15 months, that was... was that one boss or two? I can't remember. But it was the best time of my monk life, I think. Just having that open schedule. I only had about 10 minutes of chores every day. Sweeping leaves around a chetia. And there was alms around. And yeah, it was wonderful to... and I had a very nice walking meditation path. That's actually pretty hard to come by, I found. I've been in Malaysia for quite a long time. Maybe 3-4 years now, and most monasteries don't have much in the way of walking meditation paths. Here at Brahm Vihara, we've got this nice Nibbana hall, this metal roof thing with the big fans. So that's awesome for doing walking meditation, but so I really appreciate that. Yeah, so I did a lot of walking meditation. When I think of the top three teachers, okay, well, I assume, you don't want to hear me say the Buddha. That's who I would actually put number one. It's the Buddha in the early Buddhist texts. But, you know, kind of contemporary teachers. It's kind of funny how the advice that ended up helping me the most was just kind of grabbed a little bit here and a little bit there, you know, which really stuck with me and really worked. One piece of advice that really, really worked for me a lot is I read the biography of Ajahn Chah, and he had many excellent teachings, but the thing that I kind of picked up and used and did a lot with, so when I had that nice walking meditation path in Sri Lanka there, it was very secluded. And so something Ajahn Chah would do, he would pace back and forth on his walking path. And when his mind was stuck on something, you know, he had some chatter in the mind and it just wouldn't go away no matter what. And he would sort of challenge these thoughts and views, and he would be like, okay, what's up with this? You know, why is this sticking in my mind? Why do I keep repeating it? And, you know, how did this get here, these views and these thoughts, and, you know, why am I stuck attached to this? And he would ask himself these very kind of deep questions, and that helped him to trace back, you know, where did he first hear about this thing in his mind, or see it, or like, what was the origin of it, or how did he get convinced of it? And, you know, does that make sense anymore? Is it kind of true in his life anymore? Maybe it was true in the past, but is it still true today? And oftentimes he would find, no, actually, maybe something which was true for him in the past, you know, really was meaningful in the past or relevant in the past, but not so much anymore, especially now that he's a monk. And when he, you know, like he would sort of challenge his views, and he would challenge how do these views hold up to the Dhamma? You know, could we look to the Dhamma for some way to shift that perspective and let go of the attachment? And I did this quite a lot when I was in Sri Lanka. I would kind of copy this, and, you know, I did a lot of self-examination, you might say, on my own views, my own attachments. You know, why am I so attached? Why are these things, you know, so difficult for me? And a lot of times, you know, I would dig up these memories from the past that I had forgotten for a long time, and how it all started, and that was very helpful to work through why I was attached and try to like shift my perspective and my to move on from maybe some emotions underlying it all. Oftentimes there's some sort of an emotional reason we get stuck on things. We think we've got these logical and rational reasons for things, but if we are honest, actually oftentimes it's emotional reasons. There was some emotional, you know, deeply emotional event that happened in the past, and that came before we formed a bunch of logic and reasoning afterwards, okay, to kind of justify those emotions or make sense of the emotions or whatever. Yeah, so there was some kind of like digging up of old emotions and stuff, but for the sense of letting them go. And then sometimes I was able to shift, you know, my perspective on it. And then once I could kind of convince my heart to see it differently, then I could let it go. And then the thoughts were not stuck in my head anywhere as bad. It was way better. It's like I got my heart to agree to let go of those things. And then when I go in my kuti and sit down to do sitting meditation, then the sitting meditation was way easier. Way easier. Because it's like my heart was now like on board. You know, my heart's like, okay, I'm not going to struggle against you here. Now I'm on your side. Let's do this. Let's meditate. You know what I mean? That's you know, of course I didn't hear those words in my mind, but it's as though my heart had been talked into cooperating with me to do this meditation. And then it was so easy. I sit down, no problem. I hardly even had to try at all. So yeah, that really kind of blew me away how effective that can be, is when we can uproot some of these deeper views we have and sort of work through, you know, how do we get stuck on these things? You know, sometimes we get stuck on things for a long time. And how do we let go? And now, the advice I've been hearing before that point is just like, oh, you know, don't get lost in thoughts. Don't be distracted. Don't even think of the past at all. Don't explore it, nothing, you know. Immediately come back to the present. I would agree that's usually the right thing to do. It is usually the right thing to do. But sometimes we can have these deep-seated, you know, deep attachments. And it will take some deeper investigation. So yeah, Ajahn Chah doing that deeper, you know, investigation on his walking path. That I'd never heard that before. That's kind of... that was new to me, and that worked really well. But the catch is, you need a walking path so remote you're not around other people, okay? You can't do this when other people are going to hear you. Or they're going to think you're crazy. But yeah, it's a great technique, I'd say. So I'm going to say a John Shaw, really. That's one of the best ones. I would say the number two teacher, if I had to pick one, is Bhante Arya Nanda. Bhante Arya Nanda of Nahuyana. So he, I think both back then when I was there and today as well, last I heard, he's kind of the head meditation teacher at Nahuyana. He's the most senior teacher, not the most senior teacher of the whole monastery, but the most senior teacher who they gave the job of meditation instructor. And it is a Pa'ok affiliated tradition where the meditators would go to him and ask for an object of meditation, and he would hand them out. He'd kind of give you an assignment, what to meditate on. And this was very strange for me. Like, we never do this in the Ajahn Chah lineage, where some, you know, maybe you have an interview with the teacher and ask for an object of meditation, but it isn't like a regularly occurring checkup, you know, this regularly occurring assignment. And it's, you know, virtually always the teacher picking it and not really the student's choice. And that just felt really weird to me. But, you know, I was willing to give it a try. I'm like, well, you never know. Maybe it'll be good. And I went to him and I asked, I've got this problem where whenever I'm around people, I tend to lose my mindfulness really easily. Like, I can meditate quite well in my kuti all alone, or on a walking path alone. But it's so hard when I'm around other people, I lose my mindfulness right away. And what can I do, you know, around other people? Can you give me something for that? And he said, do the six sense basis. The six sense basis. And I was like, really? The six sense basis around other people? And he's like, yes. And I'm like, okay, but isn't that kind of like dehumanizing? You know, if I just, okay, like vision, you know, hearing, smell, taste, touch, you know, whatever I can feel, maybe the touch of my robes on my body, you know, and then just awareness of thoughts whatsoever. You just kind of keep looping through these six sense bases. Okay, sight, hearing, you know, I'm like, isn't that kind of dehumanizing? Like, because what I thought is when you're with somebody, you should give them your undivided attention. Should you pay attention to the other person? Should you, you know, to be courteous and respectful, right? Wouldn't it be dehumanizing if I was just like, yeah, sight, you know, there's just people, there's just some blobs over here that vaguely look like people, you know what I mean? But he's, Bhante Arya Nanda's like, no, go ahead and do it, yeah. It's not harmful, you're not harming them, you're not, you know, what are they going to know? Just try it. And I'm like, okay. And I was doubtful. I'm like, surely I'm going to get in trouble somehow if I do this. Someone's going to get upset that I'm being, you know, too, I don't know what, egotistical or something. But actually, it worked great. It worked great. I couldn't believe how well it worked. And now that enough years have gone by, I can look back with perspective. You know, this was quite a long time ago. This was maybe 8 or 9 years ago now. And I can look back with perspective, and I can see how I was in need of a correction, and he was providing the correction. And here's what I was doing wrong for so very long in my life. I was giving the people I was with too much attention, okay? Would you believe there is such a thing as too much attention? I don't really think that's in the suttas anywhere. You know, the Buddha would explain it extremely simply, you know, give your awareness to your object of meditation. And like, he means all of it, all, you know, whatever you're meditating on, all of it. there is not much ever said. I can't think of any examples where there's some sort of a concept of you might want to give some attention to this and some to that and more here and less there. Like kind of a measuring of attention. Give some here, but you know, but not all of it, you know. But the lesson I needed to hear was, and I'm speaking in retrospect here, the lesson I needed was, don't give all 100% attention to the person you're with or people that you're with. In fact, you need to reserve some attention on yourself, or, you know, myself in my case, awareness of my own body, okay? Awareness of my own, I guess, like even posture or like tone of voice or just awareness on how am I conducting myself. And also an awareness of the place and time that I'm in, okay? Like this entire room. Kind of the setting that I'm in, the setting. There's actually this nice terminology that gets used a lot, I think, in ancient Chinese culture. They speak of the field. And I think what they're referring to is like the rice paddy. And when they use this term, the field, they mean, you know, kind of like the setting you're in. It's a general purpose way of speaking of the whole setting that you're in. And it's an open, wide open area. So I am a far happier person, it turns out. I'm a far more peaceful and even, you know, bordering on joyous person when I retain awareness on myself. I retain awareness on this, the field, okay, the whole setting, the whole room. And I give you all some attention, okay, but actually not all that much. But there's a balance to that, okay, the attention is more evenly spread around. And to my mind, that's the way to be. And I'm much more mindful that way. I don't lose my mindfulness. And I feel much more peaceful. I feel more relaxed. It's kind of a much better default. I was giving too much attention to the other person. It should not be 100%. Okay, so yeah, it turns out that was some of the very best advice I'd ever received in my life as to an object of meditation. And I never would have tried it. I never would have tried it if I didn't ask Bhante Aryananda. Like, I went out of my comfort zone. You know, I trusted him. I didn't like the idea of some other teacher giving me an object of meditation, like from another lineage. And, you know, is he going to want to control my mind from now on, always giving me every object of meditation? Yeah, so is there a third now? A third teacher? I've met many monks and received many tidbits. Okay, here's a good one. Bhante Kemavaro is the name of this monk, and he's the abbot of Wat Buddha Dhamma in Australia. And now, I was in a community setting, and we had to do work projects together. And there was some community member I was kind of not getting along with, okay? I was starting to get quite upset over something where we didn't get along very well. So I went to a John Kemavaro to kind of complain about this privately, and I'm like, you know, so this other person did this thing, and, you know, I'm sure they did it just to bug me, and I'm sure they, you know, I'm sure they are secretly trying to annoy me. And then Ajahn Kim Bavara said, hold on though, like, how do you know what that person's thinking? Did you ask them? And I'm like, well, no, I didn't want to confront them. And he's like, well, you can't impute intention. You can't impute intention. And I never heard that before, and that was very helpful. So what he means there is, like, if I don't know, if I haven't asked the other person what they think or, you know, what are their feelings or whatever, if I haven't asked them, I'm just assuming, I'm just guessing. It's not fair to say that I know when I don't really know, okay? So I'm imputing, I am assuming, I am unfairly assuming. I'm adding something when I should not add it. I'm adding that here's what they think, but I don't know that. I suspect it. It sure seems that way, but it's not right to just say it as though I'm 100% sure. Okay? Yeah, so that's helped me a lot to get along with other, you know, monks, other people. Yeah, you can't impute intention. You can't impute intention. I say that's a big one. I see this happening on social media a lot. Pretty much not a day passes where I might look on social media and there's somebody extremely upset, you know, at some, like, demographic of people. Like, you know, there's millions of people that they're, you know, they're like a demographic. Yeah, they all think this. They all have this bad intention, or they're all guilty, they're all evil. But, you know, that is to impute intention. Maybe some of them are bad, but it's not fair to say they're all bad. So in Buddhism, we make our kamma, we make our, you know, we have intention and we commit the, you know, the thinking and speech and actions based on our intentions. And yes, we are liable for our own actions, but it's not fair to blame others when they weren't the ones who committed the actions. In Buddhism, if there's a father, let's say, who does some bad thing, it's that father who's guilty of it. It doesn't transfer over to the son, you know. Let's say that father grows old, dies, and then, you know, people come and they're like, okay, well, we're angry with your father because he did this bad thing, but now he's dead. So you know what? We're going to blame you instead. You're the son. Because, you know, somebody's got to be blamed for this. And, you know, so those bad deeds, like, transfer over to you. You're the son now. So in Buddhism, no. The bad deeds don't transfer to the son. It was the father who did them, and it's the father who will get the vipaka. Okay? So there is no transference of merit in this way. Not between living people like this. Yeah, you can't impute intention. Okay, moving on to the next question. This morning I mentioned a fluttering below the belly button area as a sign of jhana. It's nowhere in the suttas, by the way. But I've heard about, you know, just anecdotally amongst monks just talking about it privately. How about fluttering in sternum area or at a point between the eyebrows? Well, if you had this massive blast of bliss hit you at that exact moment, okay, maybe that was a jhana. But just taken alone, just because there was some sort of fluttering, I'm not going to say that's any sign of jhana, no. Like, the far more prominent thing is that you punch through to, like, you know, very noticeable, very strong bliss. It's as noticeable as if somebody hit you over the head with a 2x4. Like, it's strong, okay? It's not subtle. But it's pleasurable. It's not painful. Yeah, so just fluttering alone, you know, like, there needs to be some strong bliss to go with this. Yeah, I would not say just fluttering alone is any sign of a jhana. But fluttering is almost like just this little subtle side effect that, you know, is just way off to the, you know, it's sort of like it's a much more minor thing, and the jhana is the much bigger thing. Okay. If there is a flash of picture of group of children playing, or flash of a man, like how we go through a photo album, is this mental formations? Yeah, I think so. Yeah, if we see imagery in our mind, you know, while we're trying to meditate, is this a mental formation? Well, sure. Yeah. Mental formations is a very broad category. It isn't just imagery in the mind. It's never really well defined, to my mind. Maybe in the Abhidhamma or something, they would get more into this and really nail it down. What is it technically? And, you know, kind of explain it as though it was like a science. But in the early Buddhist texts, a lot of this kind of thing is, it's mentioned a lot, but not defined all that deeply. Anyway, yeah, that would be mental formations. And I would suggest, you know, try not to focus on it and return back to your object of meditation. All right. Dear John, can you please explain the 31 planes of existence? Thank you so much. Well, I don't think the 31 planes of existence are well defined in the early Buddhist texts. I think it's a commentarial thing. There are quite a few different heavens that are mentioned in the early Buddhist texts. It's kind of like, you know, a few here and four or five there and, you know, six over here. And, you know, it's never really put into a real clear system in the early Buddhist texts. It's more so just that there are devas and that there are planes of existence. And some are more refined than others. Some are, you know, kind of higher than others. But it's not made into this big system. There's a really good book on this topic that I would highly recommend. And it's, I believe the title is Buddhist Cosmology. Buddhist Cosmology by Ajahn Punadamo. Punadamo, like P-U-N-N-A. So Ajahn Punadamo is a Westerner monk like me, a Canadian, and of all the Western monks in the Ajahn Chah lineage, like me, he's one of the more rare monks who is also quite the Pali scholar. Like, he really got into the Pali, and what he kind of specialized in, when no other monk was really doing this, he was going into the commentaries and translating passages from Pali into English, which had never been translated before. Okay, like the early Buddhist texts, yes, they got translated to English. But some of the more obscure portions of the commentaries were never translated to English. And so he wanted to make a book about, you know, virtually everything stated about the Buddhist cosmology. You know, what are all these heavens, planes of existence, different kinds of devas, or different kinds of, or, you know, let's say hell beings, or ghosts, hungry ghosts, or whatever. Like, what was said, and where was it said? And what were the kind of the patterns there? And so he wrote this book, and it was very... It took him a long time to write this book. It was something like 10-ish, 15 years, something like that. A long time. And it's... He only really finished the book not that long ago. I think it's just in the last like 10 years or so he finished the book finally. And he published it free on the website of his little monastery. And the monastery he lives at is called, or it's a hermitage really. It's Arrow River Forest Hermitage is where he lives. And I've been there, by the way. It's one of the best kind of forest monasteries in Canada for being very secluded. Yeah, so that I say is really, you know, if you want an awesome answer, that's the awesome answer. Read that book. Yeah, I was. There are a couple of suttas I think I'm going to read either today or tomorrow. And they mention some of these realms of existence. And it's in the context of, like, you know, what kind of Brahmviharas do you need to develop, or jhanas do you need to develop, and then you might go to which heaven and for how long. It's some rare suttas talking about, you know, what sort of rewards do you get from all this meditating and developing the Brahmviharas and the jhanas. Yeah, but what I can say as a general comment to the question is the cosmology of how all these heavens work in Buddhism, it changes over time. Okay, it's not all that well defined at the time of the Buddha, although quite a lot is said. And then as you go later and later in the centuries into the commentaries, a lot more information kind of shows up, a lot more details, a lot more... you know, it becomes much bigger. It becomes much, you know, there's way more information came along after the Buddha. Way more information. Like, the bulk of the information came after the Buddha when it comes to all this stuff about the heavens and, you know, the different realms, you know, planes of existence and all this stuff. And most of it's commentarial. I'm not saying it is wrong or false or anything like that. But all I'm saying is that's where the bulk of the information is found, in the Pali Canon. So yeah, Ajahn Poonadamo, he'd be a fantastic monk to ask questions to, by the way. If you've got some, like, really, you know, technical questions about this stuff, he'd be willing to even answer your emails and stuff. You can just email him. And, you know, maybe give it a few weeks or so, or a month or whatever. He will get back to you. And, like, he's the kind of monk, he will go to the books and he'll, like, look this stuff up and he'll give you an awesome answer. He has a YouTube channel as well. He's on YouTube. So there are some videos he did explaining these sorts of things too. So I'd say, you know, if you don't want to read an entire book, I'm sure there's a YouTube video with maybe a summary or something as well. I'm going to save my sutras about these heavens for tomorrow.